Good morning. My name is Pearl Peterson Maduna, member of the Portfolio Committee. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Kiki Khoekwane, member of the committee.
Morning. My name is Muntungu Malo, member of the committee.
Good morning. My name is Grace Tsege, member of the Portfolio Committee.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Connie Giemo, member of the Portfolio Committee.
Good morning. I'm Denise Robinson, also a member of this committee, and it's nice to see my old friends that I used to meet when I was in the Finance Committee.
Good morning. Crystal Levenel, Research to the Committee.
Good morning. Ashva Abrams, Research to the Committee.
Good morning. Per Kakai from the Office of the Speaker.
Good morning. Rudy Tondola from the Speaker's Office.
Good morning, my name is Lunit Donlodon from the Speaker's Office.
Good morning, I'm Colleague Leswas from PMG.
Conrad Finkas, Program Manager Budget Analysis, Financial and Fiscal Commission.
Kinta, Financial and Fiscal Commission.
Tanya Ajam, Commissioner, Financial and Fiscal Commission.
I'm Bongani Kumalo. I'm the Acting Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of the Financial and Fiscal Commission.
I'm Ramak Mabukwa. I'm the Head of Research and Recommendations Program, Financial and Fiscal Commission.
Deni?
I'm Deni Ketana.
Member of the Portfolio Committee.
Thank you very much. Let me once again welcome the Finance and Fiscal Commission. We are now going to give them the opportunity to brief us. I think we are very grateful to have you here. And we also appreciate the fact that now you will be able to be presenting directly to the committee, because I learned previously we were reporting to Treasury, and some of the recommendations we were not able to then get them. So we are really privileged to have you here, and we will interact with you. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also, on behalf of the Commission, welcome this opportunity to come and address this what we consider to be a very important committee of Parliament. I think not having to repeat what your discussion with the Commissioner Ajam was prior to this engagement, I would say that it's quite an important thing that we are actually coming to speak to this committee so early into the establishment of the relevant department, and we are aware of the issues that currently beset the department in terms of getting it off the ground and such. I must say that up front that we have, as a commission, not had the opportunity to engage with the department in terms of the programs that are being pushed from the side of the department. So quite a lot of the issues that we have been dealing with here that relate to the mandate of the department are issues that basically come from the broader social sector departments, and we do believe that this process would be one process of bringing together the Commission and the department at some point to also have to build a relationship from that side. So in that respect, I think
indeed a very welcome opportunity. And it's even more welcome because we're starting this engagement with the institution to which we actually are legally obligated to report. We report to Parliament primarily, so whether the recommendations that we make have to be processed and acted upon by the executive, from our side, once we have put our recommendations, we're putting them for Parliament to engage the executive, and that's advice to Parliament primarily. So in that respect, I think this is a very good process that we have basically embarked on. In terms of our presentation, what we will do is, I am not sure how many members here are aware of the commission and its work. I am aware that, as she has already mentioned, very happy as well, Honourable Robinson, to see you after such a long time. She's the one that we have interacted with in the past as a commission in her days with the Finance Committee. And so what we thought we would do was to just introduce the commission as a role and what it actually does and how the work of the commission fits into the policy-making process. And then we will then speak a bit about the key issues that we're focusing on and the relevant legislation that you can use as a committee to actually engage with the commission. And also we will then look at some of the recommendations that we have made in the past in certain areas where we think there is not as much progress as we would have liked to see, and that's especially in terms of the welfare services aspects of the social security system. There are quite a number of gaps that we actually see and risks around that. So we'll speak about some of those issues, and then we will speak directly into the recommendations that we made for the 2012 Division of Revenue, which are currently being processed. And I'm happy to say that in terms of that, what we have basically seen from the MTBPS sounds like a positive steps that have been taken to respond to some of the recommendations that we raised, I think, in 2010, especially with respect to cushioning the vulnerable sections of the community from the impacts of the global economic crisis. Let me move on. I think the first slide basically talks about the intergovernmental relations system and how it impacts on vulnerable groups like children, women, and persons with disability. Sounds quite a rehearsed statement, but I think in terms of this process, what we need to think about is that there's quite a number of areas where the programs that relate to these groups are actually situated. And it is then important that when we look at the effectiveness or the impact of these programs, we do not look at programs in isolation, but we look at those programs as part and parcel of a cluster. And so here it's important to look at what programs sit with the national department, what programs sit with the provincial department, what programs sit with the local government sphere, and then within those spheres, how do we coordinate the programs such that we can actually be able to identify and track. From the commission side, it's about making sure that the programs that have been identified have the sufficient resources for them to be implemented. And so we might be talking about the division of revenue between and amongst the three spheres of government. And then we say for the local local government sphere, this is the pool for the national government, that is the pool, and for the provincial government, that is the pool. And then we must comment again on the horizontal allocation, one province to the other. Then we don't get into the budgets themselves, what happens in a province or what happens in a municipality. We don't get into that. But we need to track that through our understanding of the intergovernmental fiscal relations system. And that becomes an important aspect of what the commission does. Now, I think it's important that as we interact with this committee, as we move forward, these kinds of areas, even though we are saying we're looking at women, children, and persons with disability, we should be actually able to come back to you and speak to you about what is actually happening in these kinds of areas, like your health, your education, your social development, that in a very direct way, because much as we would appear in front of the portfolio committee on health or the portfolio committee on education, so it might sound like this is repetitive, but the dimensions of the programs that we're looking at are not the same. So we need to be able to rationalize that kind of an approach and build it into our interaction with this committee. Can we move on? Now, with respect to the commission itself, it is a permanent statutory body established in terms of Section 220 of the Constitution. It is an independent commission. I think the definition of independent is also in terms of the intent of the Constitution. It's really about how it functions. The functioning of the commission should not be subject to any interference by any organ of state or individual. That is the independence. Otherwise, it's also a state organ like any other organ of state. It must function in terms of an act of parliament, and that act is the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act. Now, the mandate is in Chapter 13 of the Constitution, and then there's a number of pieces of legislation that basically affect or enable the Commission to perform its function. In terms of the primary mandate, which is making recommendations to Parliament, legislatures, on the division of revenue. The enabling legislation is the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act, and also most recently the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, which I think Ms. Ajam will speak in more detail about, because it is quite a relevant instrument of ensuring that what the Commission does and its interaction with the Minister of Finance and ultimately what Parliament approves in the form of a budget must actually look like. So that piece of legislation is a piece of legislation that provides a direct link between the recommendations of the Commission and the budget process, including the budget amendment process and all of that. But Commissioner Ajam will speak to that. The primary outputs of the Commission, let me just say that in terms of the composition, I think we missed something here. In terms of the composition, the Commission basically constitutes of 9 commissioners with a chairperson and deputy chairperson being the full-time commissioners. They're all appointed for a period of 5 years, which can be renewed at the interest of powers that be. The commission is appointed by the president, nominated by organized local government, 2 commissioners, and nominated by provinces, 3 commissioners, and then the rest are national, so 4 of them are national appointees. Invariably, the chairman and the deputy chairman have been national appointees. At the moment, the reason why I'm the acting chairperson, the chairperson's term expired in September 2010, and the act basically then requires that when the chairperson's position is vacant, the deputy chairperson becomes the chairperson of the commission until an appointment is made. So that appointment is still to be made. We've got two other vacancies in the commission, so we've got at the moment three vacancies. We've got six commissioners, but I think in terms of the performance of the commission, that has not impacted in any negative way in terms of meeting the obligations that the commission has. In terms of the outputs of the commission, we have the primary output, that's the annual submission on the division of revenue. That must be submitted 10 months prior to the tabling of the Division of Revenue Bill by the Minister of Finance. It contains recommendations and proposals for the following fiscal year and the MTEF. Now, it might sound that it's just on the Division of Revenue Bill, but it's really on the fiscal framework and the Division of Revenue Bill. That's what it's about. So for 2012, those recommendations were tabled already in May. We have briefed a number of committees, including the Committee of Chairpersons in the National Assembly, and also the Finance Committees in the NCOP. We have also briefed them on those recommendations. Like I said, I'm sure that you will be getting shortly our submission on the medium-term budget policy statement, which begins to look at what the budget is likely to look like for 2012 and how the Commission's recommendations have been taken into consideration. We then have what we call the submission on the Division of Revenue Bill and the Appropriation Bill. And also here, we also make a submission on the fiscal framework separately. These are submitted in fact, once the minister has tabled his budget and the Division of Revenue Bill and the revenue proposals. The commission is required by law to make its inputs into that and recommendations to Parliament in terms of the money bills, amendment procedure and related matters act, and also in terms of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act. So those are legislated submissions. Now, we also have to make a submission on the medium-term budget policy statement, and also, like any other entity, we must submit an annual report to Parliament of how we utilize the resources that have been given to us. Now, the Commission has the power to decide on its own accord to embark on any work which is of a financial and fiscal nature and report to Parliament on that. So we sometimes embark on our own studies. In fact, in the past year, we have started the process of hosting public hearings on issues that we think are pertinent and are of a financial and fiscal nature. We host public hearings and we collect some stakeholder views, and we will be putting together a report. At the moment, we are dealing with local government issues, specifically the local government fiscal framework and the housing issues, housing financing issues in the local government sphere. Now, these are reports that we make at our own initiative. We can also conduct work or research on behalf of an organ of state. For example, if this specific committee has an issue that it requires information on or it requires work done on, it can actually approach the commission and request the commission to conduct. As long as it's of a financial and fiscal nature, the commission will be obliged to actually respond to that kind of a request and produce that kind of a report. Let me stop here and ask Tanya to take you through a few slides, and then I will give to our researchers to talk about our
I want to do is just fast forward to the issue of the money bills amendment act and why it's so important for this committee. I think that my colleague has mentioned that, you know, we haven't really had in-depth engagement with the department, but really it's not that department's budget that is of interest. It's whether the whole of government's budget is being oriented to these groups. So we need to mainstream discussion on these vulnerable groups, even though the department itself is an important catalyst in the whole gender machinery. We also have to keep in mind that we need to think about the whole budget. And if you look at the Money Bills Amendment Act, it's an opportunity for all of the committees in Parliament to really look at the budget. And I think that if you look at legislative oversight of the budget is different from executive oversight over the budget because of the representative function of Parliament. So when you look at the budget, yes, you need to look at efficiency, if you have to look at economy, but at the end of the day, you also have to look at impact on these vulnerable groups and whether the ideals that we have in the Constitution is actually becoming a reality, right? And this is the type of take we want to bring to it. So we might raise these issues in other forums, but we also believe that we need to give this these groups special attention. So I want to move on to the issue of intergovernmental fiscal relations. And I know Honorable Chair has served on a finance committee and Honorable Robinson has served on a finance committee, but I'm also aware that not all of the members would have had the opportunity to serve on a finance committee. So I'm going to actually take it quite slow to go through some of these finance concepts. And, you know, when my colleague talks about the division of revenue bill and adjustments appropriation, it sounds very technical. But at the end of the day, we know that no matter how good our constitution is, no matter how brilliant our plans are, if we don't put money to it, it's not going to happen. Okay, so therefore I realize that we are taking this committee into uncharted waters, but we believe that it will be beneficial for us as well as beneficial for the committee. So what is this thing called intergovernmental fiscal relations that the FFC exists in order to talk to? Okay, so intergovernmental tells us that we're talking about more than one sphere of government, right? Fiscal tells us we're talking about the public purse. So when we talk about intergovernmental fiscal relations, we're talking about how does money run from national, provincial to local and back. And the point is, when you have a disjuncture in this flow of funds, you're not going to get service delivery, right? And so that's why it's important, even though it is quite technical. So to give you a technically correct definition, intergovernmental fiscal relations concerns the structure of public finance in a state with more than one level of government. It's how powers and functions are distributed among the three spheres, who spends what, who can tax, who has borrowing powers, and who regulates among the different levels of government. And it's also the nature of grants from one sphere to another sphere. And very importantly, how do we coordinate the activities of all of these different spheres in terms of monitoring, support, and supervision by national sphere of subnational spheres? Okay, by that I mean, if you look at the Constitution, it says that provinces and municipalities have to deliver, but national government has got a role to monitor and to support to make sure that delivery actually takes place. So that's the background to intergovernmental fiscal relations, and it's the background to the type of submissions that we are making to you today. And the point is, we've got these three spheres, and these three spheres have distinctive roles. So typically you'll find that in most concurrent functions, shared functions between national and provincial and local, the policy-making role sits with national, as my colleague mentioned. So for instance, if you look at basic education, policy sits with national. Social development, policy sits with national. Scholar transport, policy sits with national, right? But the actual implementation takes place at provincial level and in municipalities, right? And the issue is, how then do we fund this? given that most of the money is collected by SARS, it's at national level, but the provinces and the municipalities have all these important functions, but they don't have their own revenue sources, right? So we need to make sure that the money gets where it's supposed to go, and we also need to make sure that in such a decentralized system where everybody is doing something, that at the end of the day there's clear accountability. So when something is not happening, there's a blockages. We need to know where the blockages are, and we need to know who actually needs to fix those blockages. And I think that this is the challenge facing this committee, because other committees can look at maybe energy sector, or they can look at roads. Your responsibility actually cuts across basically the entire budget of government and all city spheres, and that is quite a huge responsibility. So what's important is when your policy making is not supported by good planning, and your planning is unrelated to your budgets, and your planning and your budgets might be good, but there's poor implementation, right? And you might implement, but you don't monitor and evaluate to see that you are actually delivering to the right people, then you're actually not going to achieve any improvement in the quality of lives of women, children, persons with disabilities, and other vulnerable groups. So I think that what's important is when we look at IGFR is we must realize that all of these technical decisions can create incentives for being efficient, being effective, but if they're done wrong, they can actually undermine service delivery. So we need to make sure that all of these things work together. And I think that it's very important that we also look at distributional impact and development outcomes. By that, I'm saying that we should not just look at these allocations and the money. Okay, this is what finance people tend to look at, and this is what the FFC also in its early years used to just focus on, that division of revenue bill with the schedules that said who got what. But at the end of the day, the whole intergovernmental fiscal relations system is just an instrument to get us to making life better for vulnerable groups. In other words, developmental impact. And if we're not looking at developmental impact, then I think that we would not be looking at what we're supposed to be looking at in terms of the Constitution. Right? So I think that the issue of equity between provinces, if you are born in a largely rural province like Limpopo, does that mean that you won't have access to early childhood development services, right? So we need to look at equity both across provinces and then also within provinces. Where you live, who your family is, all of those things really determine your life chances, right? So that's also critical. And then things like governance values, is it politically inclusive? You know, are we actually drawing groups that haven't had a chance to participate in the budget process a chance to actually try and shape development through shaping those priorities that we put in the budget? Is it transparent? In other words, do we actually say if we spend so much, this amount is actually going to go to poor children? Or is it actually not disaggregated, so it's all hidden under a lot of other details, but it's not seen through a gender or a children's lens. Public participation. We know that we have one of the technically best public finance systems. I mean, we won kind of the best transparency award of OECD countries recently. Our AG is like Auditor General is like one of the best supreme audit institutions in the world. So we've made technical progress. But have we made progress in terms of participation? Or is the opportunities that we created just on paper and it's not something that ordinary communities can actually access? So I think that what I've tried to set out is that, yes, we know that this intergovernmental relations animal is a very technical animal, but we believe that it has direct impact on vulnerable groups. So if you look at the primary focus on child disability and victim-focused service provision, actually lies with provincial education, health, and social development departments, as well as the South African Social Security Agency. That just underscores the importance of intergovernmental relations. So the following programs are very important for us. These are not the only programs. And I think that over time you want to actually get through to all of the programs, but the programs that we've identified for the purpose of this presentation is early childhood development, primary secondary education, child justice and protection, and then also social development services and social grants. And then also in terms of inclusive education, looking at schooling, especially in our recent recommendations, we've also focused on children with intellectual disabilities and how we cater for them, and then victim or women-specific victim empowerment. And what we find is that there's a move towards reporting on performance. So when departments table the strategic plans, or they table the quarterly performance reports, or they table the annual reports, more and more they're having to list who the beneficiaries are. But it's only in some departments that you actually find that they disaggregate by gender. So, for instance, you'll find that health departments are typically very good about being gender sensitive. But other departments are less so, right? So if you think of a department like Department of Transport, if you look at one of the biggest factors impeding rural women's ability to integrate into the economy is mobility. They actually can't get to work. They can't drive. They don't have transport. Yet, if you look at all of the transport documentation, you'll find that there's very little gender disaggregation there. So we need to move towards monitoring and evaluation systems that do actually focus on a gender lens. And that's not going to happen overnight. But if we start asking for that information, the departments will have to generate it. Because we've never asked for it, that's one of the reasons why it's never been generated, right? So I think that it's very important in the oversight role to just keep on asking for this information. And then just coming back to funding arrangements, as I said before, SARS collects most of the money for the country, but the real expenditures take place at provincial level and they take place at municipalities. So there must be a way to take that national revenue and to divide it among the three spheres so that each sphere has got the funds that they need in order to deliver on that mandate. That process of taking the pool and actually splitting it among the three spheres is called revenue sharing, right? And if you look at the Constitution actually provides for how we need to do it. That's Section 214 of the Constitution, right? What the Constitution says is that once we have the pool of money, right, a portion of money will go to every province and to some municipalities, depending on their own ability to raise funds, and that will be called an equitable share. And that equitable share is what the province will get in order to fulfill its obligations. Now, the equitable share can be spent as the provincial exco or the council sees fit. There's no conditions to it. But you also get conditional grants. Conditional grants come from national government, and the department that's giving the grant, right, the transferring department, says to the province or the municipality, here's the grant, but you can only spend it on this. So, for instance, here's the grant, it's for early childhood development. You can't actually take that money and spend it on, I don't know, airports or roads or other sort of infrastructure, right? So the Constitution makes a provision for either this unconditional provincial equitable share, which is about 90% of what provinces get, and then there's also conditional grants. And the conditional grants is mainly for infrastructure, like building new hospitals or building roads or stuff like that. So when you look at this equitable share grant, it's distributed by means of a formula. And the formula looks at demographics. So typically, the more people you have, the more money you get from the formula. So if you look at Eastern Cape and KZN and Gauteng, because those are really populous provinces with a lot of people, you'll find that they will tend to get a lot of money. Right? Whereas Northern Cape, with a smaller population, will tend to get a lower percentage from the revenue sharing pot. Right? So if we look at the provincial equitable share, you'll see that mostly those variables used in the formula don't disaggregate across genders, right? But in some areas they do. So for instance, if you look at the health component looks at, they call it a risk-adjusted capitation index. mouthful, but basically it means looking at who will use health services more. And because women, for pregnancy purposes, in that phase of their life cycle, use health services more, they are weighted more, right? So in that component of the equitable share, you'll see that there is some acknowledgement of the fact that there are gender differences in how women access public service. If you look at the impact assessment of conditional grants on women and children, we find that at this stage we can't really do that assessment because beneficiaries are not specified by age and gender. But if the recipients of conditional grants were actually required to track, you know, who actually receives these services by age and gender, then we would be able to see whether, if we, Parliament appropriates, whether the money is actually getting to where it's supposed to be. There are certain grants that are already have gender-specific beneficiaries. So, for instance, the National School Nutrition Program, HIV/AIDS grant, those are child-specific grants. So we can hold them up as examples that are already in the system. If you look at the Expanded Public Works Program incentive grant for the social sector, that is quite women-centric, and there are also other health, sports, and libraries grants. The point is that while there are some examples of good practice, these examples really need to be made the mainstream. So that becomes the way departments actually basically do business. So to just point out that, you know, when you look at issues relating to children and vulnerable groups, like general government delivery, it really requires a lot of coordination across these different spheres of government. And when the coordination doesn't happen, you know, you might find that your service delivery doesn't happen. So, for instance, you could go and you could build a school in a rural area. That's fine, but what if there's no road or taxi route to actually get to that school? So you need to involve the Department of Transport for scholar transport, right? Then you need to make sure that the school is located close to people where people live, right? So that's human settlements and IDPs, right? I think that when you try to look at these funding instruments, you also want to look at it in the context of whether there is actually coordination and whether all of the parties really take these vulnerable groups seriously in terms of what they do. So with that, I just want to hand over to my colleague to talk to some of our past recommendations, to give you a flavor of the areas that we've looked at and some of our past recommendations that we've made.
Thanks, Tanya. What I'll do, Chair, now, is to take you through historically what the recommendations of the Commission have been. And in the main, the first set of recommendations that spoke directly to the vulnerable groups were those done in 2002. But if I actually take back, I think back quite correctly, in 2000 when we proposed the costed norm, the actual implementation of the current formula, which she spoke to in the health component, already was talking to the issue of making sure you single out the vulnerable groups. But what we actually tabled and is being responded to started there in 2002, where the first one is that of saying that the social security should be a national responsibility administered through the national security grant. So what we see now is the current national social security agency was initially a proposal by the FFC. And I think here why you had this kind of a situation is that the provincial budgets were under pressure during those years, where all the money that they were receiving in the vein, they were using their funds to pay social grants, and they could not fund enough money to pay other services. And our recommendation was that this become a national function. And government accepted that and it implemented that proposal. The second recommendation there was about incorporating the early childhood development into the education component. During those years before 2003, the education component of the equitable share did not include the vulnerable group of children there. And I think in the main there you see that's a very critical time where children learn. And then therefore it was felt that it's important to incorporate that into the funding stream, because then you develop norms and standards to be adhered to, unlike having your informal kind of institution to deal with this kind of very important service for children development going forward. So that has also been incorporated into the equitable share. The other recommendation which was made was a proposal to design a poverty alleviation package which should be aligned to social security payments with the provision of basic services. I mean, this is not directly reflected in the government response, but you would see what government has done. It actually took a decision to review the formula allocations to both the provinces and local government. And you see in the provincial equitable share part, there's an inclusion of a component called the poverty component, which directly deals with poverty in provinces. But also in local government, there's an institutional, there's a portion that deals with free basic services. So your water, your sanitation, electricity are free basic services, mainly driven with the fact that they want to target the poor and your indigent. So that has been taken care of. Moving right along, in 2006 and 2007, the Commission made specific recommendation that there be consideration given to allocation of funds to social welfare services in the provincial equitable share. You recall in 2004 when the proposal was made to shift that function to national, especially the social security payment of grants, cash transfers, the function constitutionally still resided with provinces, and it still is the responsibility of the provinces. Children in institutions need to be assisted and so forth. So the Commission at that point made this recommendation that there be specific allocation being made within the equitable share itself. Government has then therefore increased the basic components. So there are six components within the equitable share of the provinces. One of it is the basic component. So that component has since been increased. But the idea is that we would allow provinces to actually take a discretion to fund that component. So that component is now sitting at 16%. The second recommendation in 2006 was that there be a setting of norms and standards for the delivery of a defined minimum basket of social services by provinces. And the government agreed to that, and currently they have actually this work underway. They're actually undertaking a study to clearly define this basket of services. In the years 2008 and 2009 recommendation, the Commission made the recommendation that the school nutrition program be extended to secondary schools. Now, government's response was to say that even though they support this as a very, very good initiative, they felt that it would be costly. But then what you saw is that the National Department of Education responded by expanding the school quintile to cover the third quintile, which is more inclusive. What this means is that in the allocations of money to provinces, 49% of the allocations are driven by education component. And that component is driven, again, on the other side, by the when you allocate money in the province itself, by the extent of poor population in provinces, initially at 40% of those that are poor. Now that component has been given more impetus and is now weighted at 60%. So that set of vulnerable groups of poor children isn't quite quintiles, has now been extended to 60. And then therefore, the school nutrition program directly itself deals with making sure that the children are fed. In terms of the learner support material, that there be a clearly defined and its meaning be restricted to stationary textbook and teaching aids. In this case, government agreed that there should be a separate line item, but how government has dealt with this in their latest provincial budget and expenditure review is expected that they will reflect such a disaggregation, but they have actually since come up with what they call provincial benchmarks, because once you don't form a conditional grant in provinces, this money, if they are not ring-fenced, if you can ring-fence them, I think provinces will tell you that you can ring-fence this money, but we'll make sure that the money jumps the fence. But what they actually say that if it's not a conditional grant, when they're facing pressures, like if there's a need to pay salaries and wages, they don't pay particular attention to making sure that children of special needs requirements are taken care of, if they need special books and so forth. Those things are becoming soft targets and money is moved away from that. So in a way, what this recommendation was saying, that make sure that you show in your budget and plan for it and spend on those kind of learner support material. In 2009 and 10, the proposals that were made were that in the medium to long term, there be an introduction of the block grant on specifically education, health, and social development that clearly fund the services with defined norms and standards in relation to outcomes. These recommendations were not accepted in principle, but the idea here was that the same notion applies, that you when you make a decision about the allocations at the national level, you are focused on outcomes, and to say we want to make sure that all the children are educated and education is a priority, we want to spend money on education. But once that money is transferred to provinces, it's a discretionary fund, so the executive can decide to move the fund away from education and build hotels or stadiums. And the block grant principle is to make sure that when you spend this money, you spend it within education and on those desired the outcomes, as it were. But government at that point felt that it would require a constitutional amendment, because Section 2276, or rather 3, requires that the equitable share is money belonging to provinces and it must be transferred as promptly as possible. So they hesitated in terms of implementing that. The other recommendation was to carry out an independent, cost-effective, and qualitative analysis in the education and health in terms of and social wages. The recommendation was accepted, and this is as recent as last year. So what they have reflected was that this is work in progress with the formation of the new ministry in the presidency, Minister of Monitoring and Evaluation. This has been assigned a function, and that they will play this role in the future. So we'll look closely and watch this to see whether this is carried through. The other recommendation in this year was that government should review the method used to inform the national quintile rankings of schools. And again, as I've highlighted earlier on, it moved from the lowest 40 percentile, now it's covering the 60 percentile. So it's quite progressive there. In last year, 2011 and 12 recommendations that we made the previous year was that the option for social assistance reform, when we were facing the recession, we made some findings out of the research that we undertook. But in the main, we found that your child support grants and old age pensions are very critical components of our system. And during a period of recession, they actually cushion the poor against poverty. After making those set of recommendations, government actually added 8.9 billion in last year's MTEF to protect specifically your social grants and make sure that the poor are covered there. And 39 billion was added to education and health. And to make sure that there's maintenance of high access to level of education, there was an additional 8 billion added to health grants, and 18.8 billion was added to education grants as well. So we saw some quite progressive implementation of those recommendations. In terms of what we currently have, you would find that the way, why is this like saying work in progress? Annually, SSC, the commission makes its recommendation 10 months before the budget is tabled. So what would happen is that now we expect government to respond in the next budget, because we have tabled these recommendations to them after our research last year in April. So we've tabled these recommendations in April to them. They must still come in February when the Division of Revenue is tabled to respond to these recommendations. So what we have put forward here is to say that national, provincial, and local government should further reprioritize expenditure in respect of the equitable share and conditional grants to ensure that they move towards attaining the MDGs in the main 2 and MDG 6, one that speaks to universal education and HIV/AIDS as well. But in the meantime, that this attainment of this would actually make sure that there's positive impact on in the other areas of and this will have a specific spillover on them. So in that regard, we still are waiting for government to respond to this one. That also government must, through input and output norms and standards, take reasonable, measurable, or measures to give effect to inclusive education of intellectually disabled children. And in the main here, specifically to say that these norms should indicate the human, physical, and administrative or regulatory resources provided by government to make sure that there is an inclusive education. So in the next table of the Division of Revenue, it's our expectation that government should respond to this one, and we'll watch it closely. And Chair, this is the last slide. I would hand over to my colleague Conrad to take you through an expenditure analysis.
Thank you, Vincent, Chair, Honourable Members. I'll be focusing the budget analysis on the provincial social welfare department, social development departments. We're looking at this because of the child-centric nature of the programs. Also because the child-centered focus is clear in the Constitution, and although education and healthcare are the first and second priorities of the current government, there's no mention made of social assistance or social welfare in the 12 priority outcomes. Now, I'm going to look first of all at the projected growth of spending for the medium term period, that's 2011, 12, and 13. And the figures that are presented here have been stripped of the effects of inflation, which is around about 6%, 5.6%. What we see here is that on the average, provincial spending on provincial child welfare is projected to decline in real terms, not by a great deal, but by minus 0.3%. That's your over the next 3 years. If we look at the components of child welfare, the first sub-program is child care and protection, and this basically includes your early childhood development from 0 to 4 years. The fifth year is provided by the education department. It also includes children's homes. The second sub-program is crime prevention and support, and this is basically looking after children who are in the justice system, who've been convicted of some form of crime. And the third program is victim empowerment, which covers both children and women, but is the empowerment of abuse victims. Now, those are the three sub-programs that make up child welfare. And if we look at the results, the child prevention and support program is the one that is is projected to decline by the most, 1.7% over the period. Now, if we go down into the actual, disaggregate into the actual provinces, the largest real declines in spending are recorded for Limpopo, that's minus 2.4%, the Free State, minus 1%, and the Western Cape, also about minus 1%. And only two provinces is real spending, projected to increase, and that's Eastern Cape at 1.4, that's not very high, and Gauteng 0.4. Now, to just give you a sense of what that is, relatively speaking, overall provincial spending for all the functions is expected to grow at about 2.5% in real terms. So what we see here is that almost without exception, the child welfare function is being cut back, or at least its growth is lower than for the provinces as a whole, and this reflects the fact that it's not part of the 12 priority outcomes. I can move on to the next slide. I think move on to the next one. Here I just want to reiterate something that Commissioner Adjom said before. If the departments do not report on the number of beneficiaries, unless they do not report on the age and the gender of the beneficiaries, we can't undertake this analysis. So having gone through all the provincial social development annual reports, five of them have actually indicated the beneficiaries of the child welfare program and the sub-programs that make that up. That they are the Eastern Cape, Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, Limpopo, and the Northern Cape. The other provinces haven't reported, so that may be of relevance. Now, on average, about 6,527 rand is spent on a child beneficiary per year, and that's figures for 2011-12, so that's the current year. If we compare it across the sub-programs, just over 6,000 is spent on child care and protection, that's your early childhood development primarily. Quite a lot more, 14,512 on child prevention, this is implementing the requirements of the Child Justice Act, and then about rather less, 3,715 per recipient of a victim empowerment program. Now, these averages hide some very wide differences between the provinces. If you look here, you can see that on the whole, Gauteng spends quite a lot more than the other provinces across the board. So it's about 13,614 rand per child on average, going up to 31,000 for the Crime Prevention and Support Program. Whereas Limpopo, the Eastern Cape, you're looking at figures that are less than 4,000 per beneficiary. So if we analyze here the equity of the program, okay, perhaps I'd better first say this may reflect poor record keeping, but on the basis of the figures that have been released by the provincial social development departments, there does appear to be quite wide differences between provinces in terms of the equity of budgeted spending. And given the history that we've indicated that this is on a declining trend, one could argue that there's insufficient money going into this sphere. Now, overall, real per beneficiary spending is anticipated to decline by -5.7% per annum over the medium term. I'll leave it at that, and I'll pass over to Dr. Mogugu to make the final comments.
Okay, now thanks, Conrad. Let's forgive Dr. Mogugu. You surprised him. Okay. Now, just to conclude, Chairperson, on these issues, we just want to bring to your attention some of the work that we are currently engaged in with respect to some of these issues that we think would be important for you to keep on the radar. We are at the moment looking for the very first time at assessing the gender responsiveness of budgeting in the local government sphere. I think what Commissioner Ajam said was that we've got all of these programs, they sit across spheres and across departments and across, so they're all over the show. But in terms of how we report them, even though we have very clear a policy intent on gender issues and gender mainstreaming and all of that, we've got very clear policies, and the key instrument that one uses to realize government objectives is the budget. So you can have all sorts of nice ideas about what you want to do. We talk about the political representation, gender representation in politics. It's very nice. We can see the numbers. I was talking to Commissioner Ajam here, and she was saying to me, we need more women in this group that we brought here. And I agree with her. It's very easy to do those kinds of things. But when it comes to real issues that make a difference on people, the budget is the instrument. If you don't have a budget, you're not going to achieve anything. You can have the best idea. So we are beginning to look at those issues, starting with the local government sphere. So we basically identified a couple of municipalities that we will be looking at. And to try and see whether we can do that, and probably in future we blow up that, so that even as we talk the national budget, maybe at some point in the future the minister will be able to say that when he summarizes his budget, that this budget responds to these issues in this particular way, and that's where we want to go ultimately. We also have a, what we call a large-scale modeling exercise for policy analysis in South Africa. These are big macro models that we use to assess policy intents and then maybe try and make long-term projections on what the fiscal response would need to be. So, for example, you introduce your national health insurance. A lot of people... questions right now are how will we fund it and how much will it cost? So if you ask the Minister of Finance, he will tell you, no, it's a 14-year program, so you don't have to worry about it for now. We're just doing some pilots, and then we'll know as we move forward how we're going to do that. It's important, though, that one considers that in light of what also the Minister said about long-term fiscal analysis reports that the Treasury will be conducting, and that's part and parcel of long-term planning on some of these things. So this that's a model that is being worked on that simulates some of these policy intentions of government. And then there's an issue around the climate change, and I think this is a very critical area that is even more amplified by the fact that we are hosting the global event around climate change in South Africa. So there are some issues there that have a direct impact the kinds of target groups that we are talking about in this committee. In agriculture, because you find quite a lot of women in that area. Water, food security, so it's a whole range of issues that we're looking at around that. We're also assessing now, I think we've had, it's almost now 5 years of in-office schools having been introduced. Now one has to look at some of these things, what the impact of those have been. Do we have enough children at school? Have there been a difference in terms of the outcomes that we are actually getting from the school children, because we coupled the no-fee schools with also the school feeding schemes to make sure that children are actually are fed. There's also the transport side of it, which we're not doing very well on at the moment, but those are all packages that we have been using, and we need to make an assessment to check whether we actually getting what we intended to get, or there are any unintended consequences that we might want to address as we move forward. There's the issue of disasters that are normally okay, and I think I can't emphasize more what the impact on the vulnerable groups of disasters is. We can think about the rains that recently occurred and what damage that caused, and the problems affecting people with vulnerabilities. I think there's one area here that is missing, Chairperson, that relates to the funding for welfare services and the non-profit organizations. We have seen quite a lot of problems with some of these NPOs, and there have also been court cases around those as well. So we think that there's a need. I think when Vincent was talking about the recommendations in particular for 2000, the recommendations following the shifting of the social security grants to the National National Social Security Agency, he probably did not mention quite clearly. What happened there was that in terms of the allocation that the Equitable Share allocates, we were allocating money to what we call the social development component. And that component, in terms of the indicator in the pool, was about 18%. Now, that had run away to, in some provinces, around about 34%, which basically meant that some of the money that was going into a social development was being taken from other areas that were not. So if you take the total pool of provincial spending, you put it together, you find that on average they were now spending 32% instead of the indicative 18% that was being allocated. Now, when we shifted, we then said on average what our province is spending around this, they're spending 24%. So we took 24% and put it to the national department. And then we forgot that provinces were not only supposed to be spending on social security grants, but also complementary welfare services. And those welfare services basically suffered as a result of that shift. The prioritization that they should be having in a provincial budget, if you look across provinces, it's a completely different approach. And part of the reason is that there are no set norms and standards around that. We know that when we were having discussions with the Department of Social Development back in 2006-2007, they were supposed to have tabled what they called a delivery model, service delivery model for welfare services. But what I think what turned out of that was just the financing side of things that does not speak to what it is that at a minimum provinces must actually be doing. So that is all left to these NGOs and so some of them, and NPOs, and some of them basically are really, they run out of money because some of them also depended on international donor agencies and all of that. Now, when you have a global economic crisis like the one that we had, those also tend to dry out. And going forward, we need to be able to control those kinds of things, especially as we speak about fiscal consolidation, which is quite which is a very nice way of saying austerity measures. So, in conclusion, I think, let me just leave that slide there. We can talk about these things. Thank you, Chekazi.
Thank you very much. This has been very interesting, and it has actually, prompted a lot of, questions. The more you hear of this FFC, the more you get a lot of questions, because as we're saying that, I wouldn't agree more with you when you say, this committee is very important because it cuts across, various departments. It is true that most of the departments, they deal with issues that affect the target groups that we are working with. But at the end of the day, we find that very minimal is happening in various departments, especially with regards to the budget. I was listening to you when you were talking about the health department, that, citing it as an example in terms of, disaggregation of, in terms of sex and female. But we did engage with it. They were not able to give us a budget for women. So it is still very difficult for departments to do that. And thank you very much for this presentation. I will now afford the committee an opportunity to comment. Questions of clarity. Over to you, the committee. I will start with, I will go that way. Number one, Honorable Kekana, Honorable Peterson, Member Kiki, Member Ngumalo. Then I'll go to Member Robinson. And then we'll come back for the second round of. Honorable Kekana.
Thanks, Chair. Number one, I would actually concede that indeed these vulnerable groups are having, just like any other human being, multifaceted needs that must be addressed, health, education. So, you see, I'm just trying to place this committee exactly into where it belongs in the total scheme of things. The question becomes, I mean, if indeed it is multifaceted and these things are addressed by other departments, why the need to establish it if it is policy by now, after 17, 18 years, policy has been done for women, there's gender policy for children, children's charter, disability policy, those policies are there. They can be evaluated and reviewed, yes. But I'm just really, really begging to find out as to where it belongs in the total scheme of things, because unless you really say there's a need, and that need is appreciated, the budget will always be limited. So if the needs of these vulnerable groups are addressed in other departments, why do you think there was a need to establish this ministry besides the issue of policy? Because I'm saying it is there. And, you know, evaluation strategies, then the ministry with Minister Chabane and Minister Trevor for all the departments. I'm just really, really struggling to say, why did you establish, for what purpose? And unless that is defined, I foresee it will always have a limited budget, because its need is actually ambiguous. It's very ambiguous, very unclear, and as a result, you don't throw money at something that you must be aware of.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. I also want to thank you for the presentation you just gave. Has the FFC considered the 2% target for the employment of persons with disabilities? And what will the FFC recommend in terms of achieving MDG 4 and 5? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. And thanks the FFC for the presentation. You know, when I'm listening to the presentation, Chair, I was thinking right through, Kukuti, when do you take the vulnerability out of vulnerable? Because the presentation is based on social, which is education, health, and welfare. It's not focusing on other departments who could be able to make these the vulnerable sustainable and be able to stand for themselves. But we cannot always focus on social when we talk about vulnerable. We have to focus on other departments, because we want the vulnerable to be business people at the end of the day. We don't want the vulnerable to depend on grants every time. So this is what came into my mind. When the vulnerabilities will be out of this vulnerable situation, we are looking at. And the chair, when I look at the future, the research cycle, I'm thinking that at the end of the day, we are doing this for the rural child and for the rural people. But the recommendations, I don't know whether these are the recommendations or the findings of the reports, the issues of the climate change, the school fees policy, and so on. I don't know, are those the findings? What are these?
Those are projects that are actually on the go now. You'll probably be getting some findings and recommendations in May when we table our submission for 2013 Division of Revenue. Yeah.
So you see, the unfortunate part is that this is the first time we have interaction with you. So now this makes our thinking very difficult, because I always have in mind that what could make the rural better, because you have teachers, you have doctors, you have nurses that are working in the rural areas, which are paid as those who are in the urban areas or cities, and I would be glad if you can recommend that there should be a stipend and allocation for those who sacrifice and go to work in the rural, so that at the end of the day they could deliver. Because the reason why they are not delivering and there are always problems is because of the kind of the salary. There are no incentives that are there for those who sacrifice and go and work in those areas. So this is what I was thinking, and that the recommendation that you could come up with. Yes, the issues of the climate change and the issues of the school and the policy, school policy on fees, those are issues that are important. And I think the Department of Education, especially the impact on school fees, they are busy with that particular one. And the issue of the natural disasters, I think there is a budget for that. That I'm not sure how is it working, because I see in Gauteng the total area is renovated in a space time of in a short space of time. But in rural areas, the schools that were hit by disasters years back are still like that. So I don't know how does it work. So I think those are the issues that we should are supposed to be looking at. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for the presentation from the FFC. Firstly, I want to comment about your recommendation, page 9. The government should revise the method of use to inform national quintile ranking of school from 2009 to 2010. This is a very good recommendation. I'm happy that the government the recommendation was accepted, because this thing of the quintile is a really problem, especially in our townships, because maybe the school is built in the township that look like a suburb, like in Soweto there's a Protea, there's a Dikloof, in that area, but the informal settlement around that place. And the kids from those areas, from Dikloof and Protea, they don't attend school in the same area. They go to towns, but the kids from the informal settlement, they attend school in that school. And when the Department of Education ranking those schools to give them the quintiles, they give them that they don't give them no fee schools, because they say it's a suburb, little like a suburb. But the kids who attend school in that area, they are from informal settlement, and really this is a very a good recommendation from you. Really, it's going to help those kids, those schools, because there's an outcry from the principals that the ranking is very bad. My question, the second question, because that was a comment, does the FFC request information on gender programs as well as regular update from all government departments? Because maybe if you are writing your report, we are getting this report from all the departments, about your report. It's from the department or where it's from. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Some comments first, and thank you very much indeed for your presentation. It was really music to my ears to hear what you are coming up with. I think this is what our department has desperately needed, some direction about how the funding must flow, and looking particularly at the areas where there is where there are so many needs. Some of you will remember how I pestered you about libraries year and year and year on, and eventually in the NCOP they called me Madam Library. Well, it worked. Now everybody's bought into the plan of needing libraries. So now I'm going to start with my other hobby horse that I now have here, which is disability and the really poor assistance that is given to people who really cannot help themselves. So I'm very glad that you're part of this. Let me start by saying that the education side, especially tertiary education for people with disabilities, but particularly now speaking about the deaf, children who have been doing well at a normal school for deaf people where they do sign language, for example, they drop out completely when they get to an FET college or elsewhere because there is no support for them. We do not have sign language interpreters. We do not have the support systems that are needed. And therefore, these people who have ability, although they cannot hear or speak, are relegated to sitting by the roadside unemployed. And this is so bad when you consider our economic climate. People must be given the opportunity to be the best that they can be. So if this is something that you can look at, I'd be so very grateful. I think of a school in KZN that I visited, a school, it was the Fulton School, that was another one in Gillets, where they were telling me the story of a little boy who had to travel for about a day and a half using taxis and all sorts of other things to get to his school. They couldn't afford to send somebody along with him because they were a very poor family, but he had to do it all on his own. And you think of his vulnerability in addition to his disability. We need more specialized schools for children. It's all very well to say we want to be inclusive, and where you can be inclusive, sure, but there are some people who simply cannot be, for example, people who are deaf and who cannot speak. They need that very specialized education. Another project that I'm involved with is schools for children who are autistic. We have got an excellent one in Durbanville, but it is entirely privately funded. They do have sponsorships so that people who are not able to afford the very high fees are looked after. But so many people fall through the cracks. Autistic children enter that school, and some of them are what they call little blobs who just lie on the carpet. They cannot interact, they cannot fit into a school situation. But because of the one-on-one teaching and the special methods that have been devised, some of those children have ended up in schools, in, you know, what we can say, normal schools. I know of one young man who is now at the university in Cape Town. I actually helped raise funds by boxing at Century City. We set up a record for boxing for, you know, the Guinness Book of Records. Now, this is what I'm saying. We need more of these all over. Do you know how autism is increasing? Children who are born with autism, it's increasing phenomenally. We don't know whether it's a climate thing or whether it is pollution, but we need to look at that sort of thing. We have to just help, and I'm afraid government isn't doing as much as it should. And you also mentioned the NGOs that are not getting the support. Our NGOs are collapsing, and without them, we cannot do the work that needs to be done, whether we are talking about homeless people on the streets or extra education for special needs children. So transport is important. I think also about the deaf children. There's a school in Witteboom which draws on children from Delft, Hout Bay, Khayelitsha, all over, and they have to come by bus. That bus is paid for by the school. There is no support for that from government. And again, you know, people are falling through the cracks. They could go to a school where there is proper, you know, where they could be helped so that they can become, you know, the best of our people. Another thing, if I can just mention quickly, is second language requirement at universities. People who have sign language as their second language cannot get degrees at universities because they have to have a second language. Now, I've managed to sort out one problem, but we need to expand that so that this can become the norm. If somebody has learned sign language in, say, for example, English, they cannot now go and learn another language in sign language as well. And people are being denied their university degrees. And I know of one woman who matriculated 19 years ago, and she still hasn't got her matric certificate because she didn't have Afrikaans as a language. Now, those are little problems that I'd like you to have a look at, but they are budgetary. And this is where I'm very grateful for your involvement. Then I do have just one other question. I can go on forever, but I realize I shouldn't. No. All right, I just have one quick question. Now, those were my comments. I'd just like to know about your gender budgeting. You mentioned it, and how, to what extent is gender budgeting taking place within all departments? And, you know, we want to know what the targeted expenditure for programs of women in all government departments is, and we need those disaggregated figures, as you have said. Thank you very much.
Maybe whilst you are going to be responding, can you also just explain the slide 23. This technical spending for provincial health, I say. Can you elaborate as to why
discrepancies are so, some of them are so huge. Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, honorable members, for the questions and comments. I think let me start by responding to honorable Kekana's point, which is quite a difficult question if you ask me as the chairman of the commission. Normally the way we do our work is we take things as given. The decision, there's somebody that makes a decision about structure of government. Now, if I then have to respond, my response would be one of saying, does it make sense to have a department like this department that we have, given the fact that we have got policies around gender, we've got policies around disability, we've got policies around children, and so why not get on with it? The problem with getting on with it in a system of government like the one that we have is that the coordination of that, because these tend to be concurrent functions as well, the coordination of these programs, because ultimately one would like to see everybody being able to assess the impact. We do have, of course, the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation that you speak about, but it's really just monitoring outcomes that are on an annual basis, basically. We want to say, in terms of where we want to move this country from, are we making progress in terms of addressing the historical imbalances, the historical deprivation for the different types of vulnerable groups? And I think also, generally speaking, are we in line with global trends around these particular issues. And definitely there is a need for special focus and the need to recognize the link between gender and for purposes of being very direct, the role that women play in looking after the vulnerable. One cannot actually separate those and say, you deal with this and you deal with that and I'll deal with that. There's someone somewhere who needs to make sure that these are all coordinated. And I suspect that might have been the driver. And from where we sit as a commission, I think it is a very reasonable arrangement to have this kind of a department that focuses on specific vulnerable groups. Now, that then brings me to the question around when do you take the vulnerability out of the vulnerable? If you look at our submission that we made, I must appreciate the fact that this is the first time that we're meeting this committee. But like I said, we make recommendations every year. Now, when you have a lot of money, like we have had in the past before 2008, as a country we were having a lot of surpluses, and so we could actually afford to spend money and say, you know, we introduced this program, so we put people on social security grants. We could afford to argue about whether or not people were abusing the social security grants, whether or not the people that were receiving those grants, because I mean social security grants across the board, from the child support grant to the disability, foster care, all the grants across the board. We were more worried about whether people are actually accessing the grants, so we saw massive take-up rates. In fact, I remember back in 2002-2003, we were very happy. We were celebrating the take-up of the child support grant, because when it was first introduced, it was a very low take-up rate, almost like thinking, do we need this? Because nobody seems to be taking it. But once it was advertised or people spoke about it, awareness created, it just took up like that. Similarly, with the disability grant, just took up like that, because you want to, those people that were excluded from this, you want them in. Now, in that glory, because we were also getting windfalls from SARS and all of that, so we're making a lot of money so we can afford to have more and more people on the system. And we then probably forgot that there is a way in which we can actually deal with some of these things from an early age. So these children that come through broken families and they end up in foster homes, if you intervene, that system basically is supposed to intervene and redirect them in a particular direction. So you don't want them to get out of a foster home into something else. They probably get into the criminal justice system, and now you have another dimension of spending on that person. You then have these ones that come from the broken family. You get unplanned pregnancies, so you then have to have this child support plan and all of those kinds of things. If you look at them separately, individually, which is what we at some point fell into a trap of doing, we forget that the school education policy also aims to try and bring people out of poverty. The ultimate outcome of a useful education policy is that people will get out and get a job and work for themselves. And so to try and build all of those things together, you need an approach that says, what is education doing that supports what social security or the social security system or welfare services is doing? What is health doing that supports what this other side of is doing? So looking at them in a holistic manner basically means you can then start thinking about, to what extent am I going to drive this system so that I reduce the number of people in this? There are some that you will never, that you might never be able to take out, but there are some that certainly in a generation or in two generations, you should be able to have reduced the number of people that depend on the, if the whole social package is looked at holistically and you are actually looking at making it work. So you should be able to reduce the number of children depending on the child support grant, for example. You should be able to reduce the number of disabled people that have nothing to do but just to, you should be able to have programs where they can actually get in and be able to self-sustain. So the whole coordinating process of for me, of this department, basically, as a long-term vision, should be to present those kinds of alternatives on how we actually get to reduce the people from depending on this kind of a system. So it's one key area that I think is important to think about. If I look at the, you asked about there's a question about the 2% disability target and whether the commission has done. We haven't actually done any work around this, but look, if I have to do an quick introspection, as the Financial and Fiscal Commission, we don't have a single disabled person in the commission, but we have spoken so many times about it. When we go out to employ people, when is it that we're going to get somebody who is disabled to come and work for the commission? We haven't done it. So there is obviously, at the end of it, you put a target, people can meet the target. But what is it about? I think it's more important to think about it that way. What is it about? Because we can just you can't just go and employ somebody and say, we meet the target. You need to employ somebody, and that somebody must feel that they are actually employed, not to make up a number, but to actually. So in most cases, what we want to try and do is to say, those people that we bring in as interns, we must actually start looking at those kinds of people so that we basically train them. Because the kind of work that we do as a commission, even though as we look at ourselves, we are very self-critical about not actually having done those kinds of things. But it's something that I think we need to do. Now, if I then just take that experience from the commission and put it out to government, and then I'm sure we will have different kinds of answers to this kind of a thing. But certainly, I think it's an important issue which needs to be tracked, at least by this committee. And if we must report on these kinds of things as a commission, we should be able to track those things. I will ask Dr. Mabugu to respond to the issue on the attainment of the MTGs, but I'll come back to you as well, Tanya. Let me go on to the issue of the quintiles and ranking. I think what you really meant was to comment that it's actually a good idea, and I agree with you, because it's really about the best way of targeting people that you intend to target. You cannot target people by looking at the area where they live, because people who live in Alex across the road, quite a number of them go across the road. Even those that live in the shacks, the parents work for some person across the road in Marlboro or in Woodmead, so they will go across and go to school there. Does that make them rich people? It doesn't at all. And it's quite a number of them that are actually doing that in that part of the world. So I think I agree with you. Now, the issue, does the commission request information on a gender basis? Now, I think one of the my opening remarks was that we are actually working on a project right now, as we speak, that responds to that. We had a discussion with the chairperson of the portfolio committee, or he's now the former chairperson, I think he's now a deputy minister of cooperative governance and traditional affairs, and he raised the issue with us that we can do all these analyses of budgets at the municipal level, But if we don't know whether these budgets are actually making any impact, or whether municipalities are making any reasonable allocations to deal with the issue of gender, because local municipalities are really about women, and at the local level, women basically are the people that must actually deal with issues. Now, we then decided, let's just do a quick scan, check whether National Treasury information that they have on their database actually does that kind of a thing. Whether it's at a national level, or there's nothing like that. So we couldn't get that, and the reason why we've decided to go on a pilot kind of an exercise to say, let's select a few municipalities that we think might be doing this or should be doing this. So we selected a sample of municipalities that we will be looking at to just see what we can get from there. And then maybe because nobody has been requesting that information, this particular committee might actually assist us also in that direction to say we would like each department now to present its budget in this particular way. We want to see what it is that out of your budget you think is going to these vulnerable groups that we're looking at. And I think that would be a step. In most cases, they say if there's no demand, you don't get supply. Now, so you create supply, you create demand, and then you might shake up supply. That seems to oppose your basic economic principle. But yeah, the Honorable Robinson's questions, some of them I think there is. I'm glad that we've got Pat here. There is an institution that deals with the issues of language. It's one of the chapter one. Yeah, that deals with those particular issues. I think because for us, it's more of allocating resources when a policy has been put in place, then we must actually be coming in there. When there's nothing, we can only sensitize that there's nothing here. You must actually do 1, 2, 3 things, and then we come back to the resources. On the tertiary education, yeah, I think that's a very fair assessment, and also with respect to autistic children. These are really special schools. I think in the past we used to have a specific program in education, basic education, that was called Education for Learners with Special Needs. And unfortunately, I'm sure you were still in the finance committee at that point, when we were dealing with adult basic education and training, that ELSEN and ECD, we had requested that the national department must actually establish norms for and standards for each one of those, including FET. What then happened is that there's a new name that came in, which is called inclusive education. And that term probably downplayed some of the aspects of education for learners with special needs and pretended or gave an impression that, you know, this could all be lumped together as these types of... So I think it's important that this one also be raised, but... We should be able to raise this in our work now that is ongoing around education, and so there's not we should be able to have some discussions with the Department of Basic Education and Training on this. And I think one other thing that you raised that talks about beyond a secondary school, they must now go to tertiary level, and then that's the end of it. And I think that's a very important point. It speaks to some of the work that we did 2 years ago, which we stopped doing. But I think it's an important part of the work that we can actually incorporate into our work. Let me ask Tanya to respond to a few of these, and then I will ask Ramos to respond.
Okay, I want to answer the chair's question first. On slide 23, we point out a couple of huge variations in average per capita spending on the child services. So what I want to do is just cover some of the factors that have led to that variation in spending. I will ask Conrad to add more if I've missed anything out. The first reason, as Conrad has pointed out, that social development does not fall under the priority services. And you know, like when something is not a priority, unless you're active champions, it tends to fall off the agenda. I think that the second area that's important is that we've seen massive provincial overspending in provinces. And when there's overspending in personnel, it crowds out everything else. Now remember that personnel expenditure gets paid first, but these are mainly transfers to NPOs. So departments find it easier not to pay NPOs than to pay their own salaries, right? Okay. So what they do is they basically delay payments until the next financial year, but those NPOs still have to continue delivering those services, right? Okay. So that's the second reason. The third reason is that there's a problem in that you find that in the urban areas there's a lot of NPOs and there's a lot of institutions. Right? So when they budget, they tend to budget towards existing institutions rather than creating new ones. So for example, if you look at old age facilities, you'll find that Gauteng and the Western Cape has got a lot of it, right? Okay. But what about Limpopo? What about Mpumalanga? Right? So we tend to budget on the basis of operating subsidies rather than also looking at capital grants for establishing a new footprint that's not biased to the apartheid planning mentality, right? The other thing is that in your urban centers, you will get a lot of NPOs. But if you are serious about NPOs as a delivery model, you need to build capacity of rural communities to actually empower them to have their own NPOs. Don't assume that these communities will spontaneously create these NPOs. There's a lot of goodwill, there's a lot of labor, but they have been so far from the mainstream that they need support in order to get going. So if we want to redistribute the footprint for social development services, we also have to look at building capacity for new NPOs, and we need to look at capital funding, not just ongoing operating subsidies. So what you find is that because you focus only on operating subsidies to existing institutions, you tend to find that those patterns get solidified in the budget. I think that another issue relates to absence of norms and standards. In some areas, norms and standards are well-defined. ECD is a good example. If you go through the ECD norms and standards, it tells you that if you want an ECD center, you must have a place for preparing food for the kids. You need tech. So that they can wash their hands per kid. In other areas, the norms and standards are not well-defined. Now, if your norms and standards are not well-defined, you can't budget for it, right? Because there's a big difference between budgeting for one tap for 10 kids as opposed to, like, one tap for 20 kids and so on, right? The other thing is, if you don't have these norms and standards, you can't monitor it. So what the department could say is, hey, we're making a saving, so we are actually going to wire this funds away to something higher priority, like personnel. But you can only say it's a true saving if they've delivered what they're supposed to deliver and now they have funds, surplus funds over, right? So this norms and standards thing is absolutely critical, and it has got budget implications. Let me give you another example where norms and standards are often not well understood or not implemented. It's HIV/AIDS home visits, right? You find that it's not clear what the person should do, the social worker, on that home visit, okay? So you find that in some provinces, they actually budget for things like medicine, disinfectant, all of those things. So when they go and do a home visit, they do their cleaning of wounds, they do all of those things, right? But in other provinces where the rest is not budgeted for, all that you can do is make the person comfortable and pray for them. The home visit takes 15 minutes because that's all you can do. You can just make sure that they're taking their meds, but you can't materially assist them in terms of the disinfectants and all of those things like to get. So these are not just academic, these norms and standards. They're really, really, really very, very practical. And then the final thing is, I think that with the movement of Social Security, as Bongani pointed out, to national, I think that we've forgotten this social development aspect. Because the whole idea of the grant system was to recognize that you will always get vulnerable groups of children and the aged that need to be protected, but you also need to steer them towards self-dependence and self-reliance. And for that, you really need the social development services. Right? So I think that there's been an under-focus on that. So those are just some of the kind of stories behind the numbers that we're seeing there, and we hope that this committee will actually pick it up in your budget review and recommendations report. You can speak to my colleague Conrad, who can give you more data. Your researchers are quite welcome to interact with him. Okay, then on like the role of the kind of the department, I can only say what I hope the department, as it matures, will do. And I think that the first thing to do is to provide a government-wide view of what is happening in gender, right? And to do that, we need to really engender planning, strategic planning, annual performance plans, operational plans, because if we don't engender planning, then no matter how good our high-level policies, we are not going to have the basis for budgets. Then we need to engender budgets. And then we need to engender monitoring and evaluation so that we can see that the activities planned and the resources allocated actually got where it was supposed to be. Now, that's a massive task. And I'm glad that somebody, the department, has that task, and you know, we will do our best to try and support them in that. Then the issue that was asked, do we get gender reports from all of our government? That's the department's role. We hope that they will get this information and share it with us so that we can analyze. But we don't want to approach institutions and ask them to report 5, 6, 7 times on gender-related issues. There should be one focal point, and that is basically the department. I think that there are also certain systematic issues that we are raising that will cut across entire provinces, entire departments, like, for example, shifts in functions, which this department could really look at, where you're not looking at any individual sector, but you're looking at the interface between different provinces, different sectors, because a lot of the problems actually happen where that interface is actually not working properly. And then finally, I just have to say that issues like gender budgeting, nobody has even solved it in detail, even internationally. So you have to develop new ways of doing it and also ways that can work here. And I think that if this department can play a role in looking at those issues and disseminating good practice on it, it will be absolutely excellent. Okay, then I think there was a very good question that the Honourable Member asked, why are we only focusing on social issues? I think that we picked a couple of the obvious ones for this initial interaction, but I fully agree with you. We need to go further, and hopefully in our next interaction with you, we can discuss the work that we're doing on public transport and gender. Because if you look at the lack of public transport, it actually hits poor households. And who are the main poor households? It's female-headed households, right? So we have done some work on that. And what I'm hoping is that this work that we're going to be doing on food security, on infrastructure, on housing finance, we can also look at those issues so that next time we engage with you, we don't only bring this, we also bring those issues now that we understand what you're focusing on much better. You know, to also just talk about the disaster management issues, we actually have a project, in our project on disaster management, that was one of the questions we asked. And one of the reasons why urban response is quicker than rural response is because the structure of a grant says to government, spend now, then you claim back. Right? So municipalities, metros, they have got enough internal resources to spend now and then pay back. They don't get it, but the poorer municipalities don't have the funds to bridge finance that grant. So that's one issue that we've raised as an issue that we really need to follow up on, the structure of the grant.
given that the whole Disaster Management Act is now being reworked, so there's an opportunity to think about those areas. I'm very glad that you like the Quintal 5 recommendation. Please support it in your budget review and recommendations report. We would love to see it there. Honourable Robinson, on the libraries, you'll be pleased to know that the FFC actually made a recommendation on unfunded mandates to municipalities, and libraries were high up on that list. So I think that that's an excellent point. Just to talk about children with disabilities, I think that we underestimate the need for additional support, but also the potential for additional job creation. Because if we have to employ somebody to help that kid get from A to B on public transport, then I think we should employ somebody and create a job at the same time. On the autism, I have to say you also struck one of my favorite pet topics, mainly because I have two autistic nieces and nephews. They go to wonderful schools. What bothers me is that they are lucky because they're urban. They are lucky to have chosen the ovarian lottery, to have a family that can really support their development. And I think that the question is, how do we make sure that other children in the same position also have the same life opportunity? And so I think that those are kind of like my responses, and then maybe if I can just hand over to my colleagues.
Yes, thank you. On Honorable Peterson, question around the Millennium Development Goals, in particular MDG 4 and MDG 5. So let me start by saying MDG 4 speaks to a reduction in child mortality. And the essence of it there is to reduce child mortality from about 62 per thousand in 1990 to something like 22 in 2015, 22 per thousand. And for maternal mortality, it would be reducing it in 1990 from 230 per thousand mothers by three quarters. That's MDG 4 and MDG 5. Now, what has happened is that child mortality was 62 per thousand under 5 in 1990 and is currently at 65 per thousand. Latest figure that we have. So instead of reducing it by two thirds since 1990, it has actually gone up. The wrong way. The same with our mothers or sisters. 230 per thousand in 1990, and we're now sitting at 410 dying per thousand currently, instead of reducing that by three quarters. Now, where are we sitting? We're sitting 4 years away from 2015, when the Millennium Development Goals are due. So by 2015, we must have reduced the rate of death of our children, our mothers and sisters, by around two-thirds or three-quarters. But as we speak now, those figures are going the wrong way. What does one do? Well, the Commission worked on this issue, and we have a recommendation currently on this particular issue. If you try to attain the Millennium Development Goal 4 and 5 between the 4 years that are left, the reality of it is you want your health budget to rise from 3.9% of GDP currently to 8% of GDP. So you want to pretty more than double the share of output that's going into health in the 4 years that are facing us. Can it be done? It has never been done anywhere else. It has consequences for the health sector itself, whether it can absorb those kinds of resources. It has consequences for all the other programs that we are talking about right now. And it has consequences for the World Health Organization directive that, on average, for a working health system, you should be spending around 6% of your national output on health. So that's the first reality check, that can we reverse the trend between now and 2015? Chances are we cannot do it. But what can we do in the interim? Well, in the interim, the biggest issue around health is at least to turn the tide. When I started, I said our indicators are going the wrong way. Instead of going downwards, we're actually having our children and mothers dying even more than in 1990. Present. Well, we now have a fair idea about what is causing our children and mothers to die. HIV/AIDS is a big contributor to the deaths that we're seeing. That's one element. The second element that we now know is that more and more of our mothers, sisters, and children are now dying actually in care than outside the care system. So previously, people would die in their own homes or outside of the healthcare system, but now more and more of them are dying within the healthcare system. So two major causes of the deaths that we are talking about here. If we tackle HIV and AIDS effect on the deaths, and if we tackle what happens within the healthcare system itself, because a lot of the deaths are occurring within that system. So what does the Commission recommend? Well, the Commission recommends that focus on the HIV and AIDS. In other words, reprioritize a lot more, even within your baseline, to speak to the HIV and AIDS aspect. Just by doing that, you pretty much target close on two-thirds of the deaths that we're seeing. And then the second element is focus on fixing the health system, because we know that a large chunk of people are dying in care rather than outside care facilities. So we make recommendations that say, again, focus on your primary health care, focus on the system within your existing baseline. So that's why now when you look at our recommendation that Vincent spoke to, we are urging more and more the national, provincial, and local governments not just to reprioritize their budgets, but to also move them more in the line of addressing HIV and AIDS and primary healthcare system, re-engineering it, if it can be fixed according to what the minister refers to as the 10-point plan within the health system. If that can be resolved and actually implemented, it's going to turn the tide. We will not be able to meet the Millennium Development Goals, but that is not such a big priority if you can turn the tide of your children, sisters, and mothers dying. That will be.
Thanks, Chair. We can take it.
Thank you very much for your responses. I'm just looking at members to see as to whether they still want to have some more bites. So are you but please ask relevant questions to fiscal, not department's questions, like the previous question. I mean, it's quite relevant to the department rather than the commission.
Yeah, well. So, okay, then. I mean, the point is that it isn't the department who's going to solve our problems, all of us together, sharing ideas, because we work as an integral part of the whole thing. In fact, those that you might not expect to have solutions might be the one that comes in solutions. When you're expecting solutions, solutions might not come. So we're searching for solutions to problems, and we try everything possible. I just want to hear their opinion. We have already identified that education is going to be key in addressing the issue of social welfare and so on, the issue of gender itself, for example. But I mean, with gender, where the words patriarchy and inequality was simply because women traditionally were not given opportunity, that will empower them. So if I empower women, if a woman is an engineer, there's no man that can oppress her, there's no society that can oppress her. So that thing of education is very important, and we have, in the, especially for the vulnerable groups, that take them out of vulnerability, the way to empower them, because if they don't have skills, it's going to be difficult for all of them to be employed. So I'm just saying, and it is said that, and we said that in the past, that the South Africa is said to be a young nation in terms of 70% is youth. All the old people in another 20, 30 years, including you, Chair, and me, would be dead. And as a result, we should start preparing this youth. If we don't prepare this youth to be independent, because this is what education does and skills, it makes you independent. You don't depend on social welfare. If you want a house, you can buy it. If you want income, you can have it because you work the way naturally you should work for yourself through your own sweat. So it seems like that is right at the core of our problem. And the way we're doing, I don't think we're doing well enough. If you've got 65% of the youth that have passed matric unemployed, including them girls, they'll remain subordinate for as long as the man is the one who must be a provider at home, no matter how much we can scream about gender equity. So this issue of empowering our nation through education, I don't know how we're going to tackle it, because so far I don't think we're doing well. And it is such a thing that is at the core of independence, of liberation, of having a better society. So I'm just asking what you think we can, what is the next step? Maybe, Chair, already you've ruled me out that this is not relevant, but I'm sure you have your own ideas. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kitana. Member Robinson?
I'll just raise the point. I won't discuss it at all because I know we're challenged for time. Victims of abuse, this is increasing all the time. We have very few Tutuzela centres, and the other centres that we do have are usually run by NGOs or churches. That is a desperate need to help women to deal with the problem, to have a safe haven. And then relating to the deaf again, I think it would really help if government created or helped with funding hostels in which the children could stay so that they could be on the premises close to the school, especially in rural areas. Thank you.
Anything from your side, or maybe those were comments? Over to you, Tanya.
Yeah, I just want to underscore that I fully agree with you that education is critical. But I also want to highlight that at the end of the day, it needs to be education, but not just of women, but of the whole society. Because I've actually worked in Indonesia. I've actually been in the Middle East, where women actually have PhD degrees from Oxford and Cambridge, but they don't speak in public forums. And so I think that we really need to look at, we've got for the first time, we have a schooling sector plan, Schooling 2025, that's taking a long-term view of education, there's an action plan that goes with it. And I think that if this committee could liaise with the Basic Education Committee to try and see if we can see how gender is actually integrated into that plan as kind of the way of doing business. The other important thing is that recently government has released a family policy, which is also critical. And, you know, we need to see how these things can actually contribute.
Just to add on to that, Honorable Kekana, I think what you're raising is a very critical issue of, when we educate people and then suddenly we find that they are unemployed, they can't get into a job. What is the purpose? And I think it's an issue that a lot of people these days talk about jobs for the future. And what does the future look like? So, for example, a child, you are talking about 30 years' time, a child who goes into grade one today, the kind of a job that they are going to go into, is it the kind of a job that typically 30 years ago the same child is actually going into today? So what we must be thinking about, if we have to think that long term, so we have to say there are two points to this issue of youth unemployment. It's what we can do now to address the problems that we have today with the current youth, and what we can do for the future generation that will come up when you and I are dead. Or did you mean the other chairperson? But yeah, so both of us. So that we have to be looking at it in that particular context. I think the former basically has to do with quite a number of initiatives that government is taking. I think there's a clear realization that the education system was quite disjointed between basic education and then post-secondary education and all the way to your university level. It was very disjointed, and I'm not even sure whether the separation between the national department and the higher education, and basic education recognizes that bridge that it was actually the missing link which creates this. We've got a very large number of dropouts from the schooling system. I think the numbers that we did, was that 2008, Ramos, when we were, the massive dropout between primary school and, let's say, grade 7 and grade 12. So you get a lot of repeating people there, and then they drop out by the time you get to grade 12. You almost have two-thirds of what you had at the beginning. Then by the time you get to your tertiary or higher education system, a significant amount of those people have literally disappeared, and there are no skills, there is nothing. It's just some of them don't even have the matric certificate because they dropped out. So fixing the issue of unemployment now and linking it to the education system requires something extra outside of the education environment. And so the training aspect, which is your vocational institutions and all, becomes important, but it cannot be the government alone that can resolve the problem that we have today. But we can plan for the future when we think about what the jobs for the future look like, because definitely it's not going to be the same thing. That's what I can say. We haven't completed the work that we started in 2008 in that respect, but there is some work that we are actually doing in that respect.
Yes, I think what I'm going to say is not one of the
exciting things, but perhaps actually fundamental. I think for a committee such as this, there are two things here. The first is the issue of universal primary education. What has happened with that? We are almost at universal access as far as primary education is concerned. So what is the challenge? It may not appear a very exciting job to do, but if you can ensure that that's maintained going into the future and we don't lose hope, in other words, we consolidate on the gains that we've made. That on its own is a big job for a committee such as this. It's usually easy to get these targets, get access to primary education to 100%, and overnight, because of, say, political ramifications, you lose that, and you are back where you started. So how do you put in place systems to ensure that that's sustainable gain? The second one is the issue of promotion of gender equality. When you look at primary education, secondary education, and now even tertiary, checking those ratios, South Africa actually has a reverse kind of problem where more girls than boys are participating in the schooling system. Again, the question is, how do you sustain that? How do you put in place systems to sustain that, at least on the basics, the kind of things that, from received wisdom that we know will eventually contribute to the jobs that we're talking about, the future that we all strive for? If we have started doing it right, how do we keep it going into the future? Even when we see our children getting unemployed, it doesn't mean we destroy the universal access to education that we have. It doesn't mean we destroy the gender equalities that we have attained. Because the issue of jobs really depends on some other variable called economic performance. How is your economy performing? Well, now, let me focus on that. What do we know about gender equality in the economy? Well, we know that given the structure of the South African economy currently, most women are in agriculture and textile and don't really participate elsewhere in reasonable proportions outside of those sectors. So where to make inroads now is to start thinking, how do we turn that tide around of moving from being highly represented in agriculture and textile into the sectors that are likely to drive the future economy? That doesn't mean you dismantle your universal access to education, your gender equality things that you have attained, because those on their own are probably 60% of the explanation of why people get jobs in the first place. Without those, you can do all the fancy footwork you want about making targets at the high-end stream of the economy, etc. But if they don't have these basics that your committee deals with and should ensure that we keep on track, it's not going to happen. So I'll say sometimes just, I'm not saying be less ambitious, but keep the gains that have been made and put in place systems that say this legacy will not be lost. This is this generation's contribution to this big debate, and we've put in place systems that say what we've got in terms of access, in terms of gender equality, we don't lose at the very least.
Let me thank the commissioner and the team, the chairperson, acting chairperson and the director. I must say that I don't think I'm the only one, you know, that has been inspired by, you know, your contributions in as far as our role as the committee, because it actually informs us of those issues that we as the committee need to take up with departments. You know, we are a very powerful committee, but perhaps we don't realize it. Taking into account what the acting chair said, you know, also about, you know, oh, Dr. Mabugu said that, you know, we should consolidate the gains that we have made. We are aware of all those that you have mentioned, you know, being, you know, participation of women in different sectors, you know, for their empowerment. We also note the fact that, you know, in terms of economic empowerment, women still lag behind. And that even the contribution, you know, that is made by women, it's not recognized. When you look at the GDP, for instance, women contribute a lot, but because it's unpaid labor, you know, that is not taken into account. But let me again thank you for your presentation, and I hope that you have given us a lot to engage with the various departments. Honourable members, thank you very much. And the department, the office of the Deputy Speaker, everyone else, thank you very much, and our meeting is adjourned.
Okay, thanks.